Those who are mystically inclined or religiously bent will inevitably weary of the foregoing pages and mutter impatiently at their semi-scientific a quarter century ago, as a consequence of TH copyright full-time practice of meditation in virtual solitude. The present writer underwent in Europe the series of mystical exaltations in the deep trance state referred to in the first chapter. Afterwards he returned to social existence, but found that all activities seemed empty and purposeless, all persons mere wraiths. Such was his unbalanced state resulting from mysticism unchecked by philosophy. The philosopher, on the other hand, does not lose his balance in the slightest way. Detail. This is because they do not understand that we are engaged upon a momentous journey and that if we are using science we shall not remain in science. They yearn for inward ecstasies of the soul or new revelations of deity. Let them learn that we are on the move. If we have taken this deep plunge into mentalism, it is because there is no other route that we could take if we are to carry out the allotted task of leading them intellectually to the true God, the real spirit, and to that satisfying realization of soul which can alone endure. The way to the promised land lies through the wilderness of seemingly arid facts, but this need not cancel out the enjoyment of peace-filled meditations. For right reflection upon these facts will yield understanding, and this effort, when made with proper concentration, rapt absorption and repetition, is the yoga of philosophical discernment. We are not moving farther away from God, as the ignorant may wrongly think, but actually moving nearer. We need not give up the grandeurs of mystical ecstasy for dull and dry intellectualism, but may retain them, the while we discover a permanent satisfaction that will not come and go intermittently like these ecstasies. Let not these criticisms be taken amiss. Let them not blind us to the true worth of yoga in its rightful place and within its lawful limits. There it can help much. And we may now see the deep and practical wisdom of the early Indian teachers who prescribed yoga to those whose intellectual power was not strong enough to grasp the truth of mentalism through reasoned insight, for thus these men were enabled to arrive at the same goal through feeling, not through knowledge. For the same reason these teachers also prescribed the study of illusions to ordinary people, because the sciences of physics, physiology and psychology were then too primitive to afford the comprehensively detailed analysis which has been made for modern students in the foregoing pages. However, the yogi untrained in philosophy is always in danger of losing his conviction that the world is idea, because being based on feeling he is subject to the law that feelings are always liable to change. On the other hand, the yoga-prepared philosopher can never lose the profound insight he has gained through the use of pure reason. It is something that has grown up within him and achieved maturity. He cannot ungrow it any more than a year-old infant can ungrow itself and get back into its mother's womb. Permanent certitude must come through making the truth of mentalism our own, with a rigid certitude which needs no proper fallible authority or fading emotion. Such certitude can arise when this the downfall of materialism/truth is seen, not even as scientific theory but only as scientific fact. Yet we must never forget that mentalism is only a step leading to ultimate truth. It is a hurdle which blocks the path of the truth seeker. It must be climbed and crossed. In its own place this crossing is of vital importance. It is also a temporary ground which the questing mind must occupy whilst consolidating its first victory, the victory over matter. Once the consolidation is fully effected, it must begin to move onwards again. It must leave mentalism. The ultimate reality cannot consist of thoughts, because these are fated to appear and vanish. It must have a more enduring basis than such transiency. Nevertheless, we may see in thoughts, to which we have reduced everything, intimations of the presence of this reality, and apart from which they are as illusory as matter. The further and final battle must lead to victory over the idea itself. Both materialism and mentalism are tentative viewpoints which must be taken up and then deserted when the ultimate viewpoint is reached. Then alone may we say, this is real. Hence, if we must close this study with the questions, what is a thought? And what is the mind? Regretfully left unanswered, this is because those answers belong to the further and final stage of our journey, which not merely the necessities of space and the compulsions of time bid us reserve for a later volume, but other reasons which are more important still. Meanwhile, it is essential to study well this basis of mentalism, because upon it shall later be reared a superstructure of stupendous but reasoned revelation. The foolish who cling to what is personal when all the pangs of a suffering epoch teach the futility of doing so will be dismayed at the apparent blankness of these teachings, and they may turn away with a shiver. But the intelligent, who have learnt much, thought deeply and suffered long, will be ready to accept it, blankness and all. For they will understand that in so doing they are accepting truth after lies, peace after pain, sight after blindness and reality after illusion. If later they pursue it to its farthest end and gain the fullest realization, thereafter they shall beat out the measure of their days in an interior harmony that shall be more holy and more blessed than any ritual of religion could ever be, more serene than any yogic experience is likely to be. Thus far we may not have outpaced, except in certain slight hints, the foremost Western cultural thought. If those who have pursued technical courses in philosophy find some of these tenets familiar, their indulgence is craved, and they are asked to remember that those pages are written primarily for anyone who cares for truth, whether he has some academic acquaintance with philosophy or none at all. Ramifications of this doctrine are already known to the West under the technical term of idealism. Nevertheless, it must be pointed out that this is a generic term covering contradictory tenets. Whoever studies in their totality the absolute idealism of Hegel, the subjective idealism of Berkeley, the objective idealism of Kant and the nihilistic idealism of Hume, for instance, will depart bewildered and confused. For it will be like studying religion, a word which may mean the gibberings of Central African Negroes around a grotesque wooden figure or the quiet still meditations of Quaker Christians. Nobody seems to know the truth about idealism or the falsity of it. There are idealists who accept God and idealists who reject God, just as there are idealists who uphold the existence of matter and idealists who deny it. In any case, beyond idealism all reflection shades down to twilight and then darkness, for even the proponents of idealism perceive nothing but mystery beyond it. Every step forward into that mystery that they venture to take causes them to lose their way in guesswork and speculation. Only the hidden Indian teaching has bravely and boldly explored and explored successfully the lands which stretch from idealism all the way to final truth. Bishop Berkeley had the quaint notion that those whom he ignorantly termed idolaters might be persuaded to relinquish their worship of the sun could they but learn that it is nothing more than their idea. It never dawned on his pious mind that the God whom he posited in a lengthy argument, which incidentally is full of fallacies, as having put the ideas of the sun and of all other external objects into the minds of men, was only an idea also. For this personal and providential God was an imagined one who did not exist independently of Berkeley's thinking. But there is neither the time nor place to enter into academic argument here. This book is not a treatise on metaphysics, it represents a formal and final testament of truth. However, it may be advisable to explain to those who fear that the hidden teaching necessarily leads to atheism that the term God is not a term to our taste, because it means all things to all men. But descending to an unphilosophic level, it may be affirmed that we shall find God at the end of this quest, but it shall be God, as he really is. It shall be neither the glorified man of religion nor the attenuated gas of metaphysics. Yet it shall still be the God whom men rightly but remotely revere in Oriental temples and Occidental churches, in the downfall of materialism, sun-splashed mosques and grey brick chapels, but whom they tread underfoot and try to torture with their ignorant hatreds and intolerant persecutions of other men. We shall find the God whose caricatured image scornful rationalists or bitter atheists rightly reject and against whose cruelty they justly rebel, but whom they wrongly deny. For he is none other than their own ultimate self. We shall find the God whom lean ascetics seek but do not find in gloomy caves and starved bodies, and upon whom satiated sensualists shut the door in nightclubs and jazz halls, yet who paradoxically dwells in both cave and club unseen, unnoticed and unknown. We shall find that God whom meditating mystics and trance-rapt yogis prematurely grope for within their hearts, God's aura of peaceful light is all they touch, for the flame would shrivel their ecstasy-seeking ego in an instant of time, but once they have obeyed the angel whose sword shall sooner or later drive them back to the world they would forsake, and learnt what this thing is that surrounds them, search into the self will soon yield its final secret for them, as ancient Indian sages have pointed out. All these men who have vainly yet unconsciously tried to displace reality and who have set up for worship a god of their own imagination, a mere idol of their own making, philosophy will lead to the true God, whom they shall henceforth worship in full awareness of what they are doing. Finally, we shall find that elusive world essence now unknown to scientists and which they think to be some kind of energy. We may now begin to grasp why I was always taught in secret. The books and texts were kept in the possession of the teacher, to be revealed and expounded only when candidates had traveled through the other paths. It would have been unwise to teach the general public. Men cannot bear to learn the truth about the real nature of this world, and so they flee from its first glimpses towards the immediate comfort of illusory existence. For the notion that TH section RE is a material world confronting them and existing outside them is instantaneous, immediate and irresistible. It is not something which they arrive at by any laborious process of logical reasoning from something else. It is a self-evident overpowering intuitive perception which seems undeniable and which apparently does not depend on any worked out case which is liable to be overthrown. Only a continuous series of clever questions spread over a long drawn course of personal instruction could ever show the ordinary unreflective man that his materialistic realism is foundationless and that the philosopher's thought out gentilism is based on solid rock-like fact. The great fear that descends on anyone when he learns that matter and space and time do not exist apart from man himself is unjustified. For this non-existence does not deprive him of the sensations of matter and space and time. Is it not enough to see an apparently objective world extended in space and to watch its events extend in time and to feel its solidity? Mentalism does not rob him of these sensations which he experiences. It merely explains them. What difference does it really make to give up his illusions about them? Why should he demand anything more than truth itself? For philosophy must stick to facts. Sensation is a fact, but matter, time and space are proven suppositions. Here philosophy is far more rigorous than science. There is no tangible difference in his practical life and only a rectification of wrong notions in his mental life. Chocolate will taste just as sweet and just as delicious when he knows it to be a cluster of sensations as when he erroneously believed it to be a material substance, whilst the engines of his car will purr away as noisily as before. He will lose none of the things he cherishes, none even of the joys of life, only he will understand them correctly. For the streets, the houses and the people around present precisely the same aspect to the sage as they do to the ignorant man. The former, however, is enlightened by reflection and thus knows that these varied forms are all mental. He knows too that mind is the stuff of all these productions, whereas the latter is quite blinded by unreflection to this truth. Mentalism staggers the simple-minded with its apparent profundity and complexity, yet once well inquired into and therefore well understood, nothing could seem more simple or more apparent. Thus the ancient Indian sages wrote down a teaching which foreshadowed some findings of the best modern Western scientists. The same science which gave us the bleak hopelessness of mortality and materialism last century will give us the bright hopefulness of mentalism in this one. Truth will be established on a basis of proven demonstration, it will need nothing mystical to support it. The time is riper for the world to come to this age-old truth, but it must come to it in terms of 20th-century scientific concepts. This doctrine has remained insulated from the world long enough. Nor will it suffice merely to translate its teaching into Western tongues, it must also be constructively interpreted. We live in an age of revolution. Kings, governments and constitutions have been hurled from their pedestals and familiar scientific concepts have been hurled out of laboratory windows. but the greatest revolution of all in the world of 20th century knowledge is that which the front rank of scientific investigators, the downfall of materialism, is effecting before our eyes. This fundamental turnover in the outlook of educated men will consist of nothing less than bringing the whole world into the circle of thought and thus converting matter into idea. Just as the study of radioactive substance opened a new horizon for science when its old lines of research seemed to be at an end, so this study of the relation between the world and man, between matter and mind, will before long end in the discovery that the entire panorama of the world, from telescope-seen star to microscope-seen cell which confronts our eyes, is in reality a mental construction. It will destroy materialism root and branch, and will throw wide open the gates which lead to the infinite reality whose knowledge is truth. Epilogue. The philosophic life hath this teaching has been forgotten, neglected and misunderstood for so many centuries in sleepy monasteries or remote mountain caves is not its own fault. It is the fault of men. Those who could understand its immensely practical bearing, its vital immediacy, were necessarily few in number. Such understanding could be got only by arduous intellectual efforts beyond the capacity of most men. But generally we get what we pay for. The one teaching which could guide mankind to the right solution of difficult problems is to be valued accordingly. It is a costly genuine diamond, not a cheap bit of glass. We live in a practical world. Men may theorize as they like, but they have to act, to work and to deal with other men. Therefore the question must come up, will this teaching make any difference to the way in which people live on earth? For it is a widespread belief that philosophy is aristocratically cut off from the pressing concerns of everyday existence, that the philosopher, if not a fool or even a lunatic, is a hopelessly impractical man occupied merely with manufactured problems, and that the pursuit of truth is a pastime for those who have no burden of practical responsibilities, or for library crawling bookworms, or for armchair dreamers who wish to escape action. It is widely believed that the philosopher makes an unnatural dichotomy of attitude between the inner life of thought and the outer life of action. This may be true of that merely metaphysical speculation or theological web-spinning which passes itself off for philosophy, but it is not true of genuine philosophy, such as some of the best ancient Greek citizens followed, whilst utterly untrue of the hidden Indian philosophy. If so-called philosophy has lost touch with life, this is because it has lost itself in a maze of long technical words, or made such a fetish of clever logical subtleties which delight nobody but dialecticians, that it has forgotten its foundation, the facts of human experience. Perhaps in no other study are men so carried away by sounding words and polysyllabic names which disguise, epilogue, the philosophic life error and crystallize fallacy. And in no other study has such a forbidding terminology arisen with so little necessity. A philosopher who cannot say what he has to say with a minimum of long, difficult and unfamiliar words, but must get himself involved into using a maximum, is not only likely to get himself involved in hidden untruths, but is sure to keep not a few sincere aspirants outside the portals of philosophy itself. If such philosophy has vanished from everyday ken into a verbal vacuum, or fallen from high regard into contempt, then the so-called philosophers themselves are to blame. They write their thoughts down in a technical jargon which hides meaning and harms clearness, and which builds forbidding bulwarks of unintelligibility around the grandest truths. They construct systems of reflection about the world and about life which do not take into account the primary facts of the world and life. They ignore the tremendous asset of science and find themselves left to play with their own fancies. They start their reflections with the arbitrary fancies of other philosophers instead of starting with the verified facts of the world that confronts them. In this they are curiously like unto mystics. They imitate each other and get caught in the literary history of philosophy instead of actively creating fresh philosophy. What is the business of philosophy? What definite end has it in view? What is the proper vocation of a philosopher? What are the practical lessons of philosophy? The briefest answer to all these questions is, genuine philosophy shows men how to live. If it could not do that, if it could not serve practical ends, it would not be worth having. It does not toil through the profoundest strata of thought merely to become alienated from the suffering world. It does not end in abstraction, but in action. The fruits of philosophy can be gathered only on this hard earth, not in some remote metaphysical empyrean. It embraces an individual and social labor which must visibly contribute to the welfare of our race and make itself felt in living history, or else it is not true philosophy. It must justify its existence by what it can do, not only by what it can imagine. It must show men not only what they really are but also what course of life should be the object of their behavior. The fact is that philosophy does make a revolutionary difference when applied to human existence, expressed in human deeds and inlaid in human intercourse. It is the deep-held desire of those who are the living custodians of the hidden teaching in our tormented age that the artificial divorce which exists between philosophy and practical life should come to an end. It is their heartfelt wish to bring men to realize that philosophy is intimately linked with life and is useful as a guide, an inspirer and a judge. It will be one of the missions of the subsequent volume to challenge the validity of the common criticism that philosophers can deal with concerns that are too remote from everyday life to be of use to anyone. It will be shown that the very contrary is the correct case so far as the hidden teaching is concerned, for its fine teachings affect every moment of a man's earthly existence. For philosophy is not a pale fiction fit for dreamers only, it is primarily for men living in the world of action. It is interested in the full circle of existence, not merely in a segment. The moment we begin to reflect upon life, the moment we begin to consider the lessons of experience, the moment we search for meaning or explanation of the world in which we find ourselves, that moment we become a temporary philosopher. Where the specialist philosopher goes farther than us is when he demands that all experience be taken as the material for reflection, that the experience of all existence be meditated upon. But the critic will ask how can that be when history has not written its last word, experience is continually increasing and life never comes to an end? The answer is that just as a circle may be indefinitely enlarged without ceasing to be a circle, so experience may be continually expanded without the truth of experience ceasing to be the truth. And that truth is the philosopher's final target. This is why he must work methodically, why he must first establish the true meaning of universal experience and then seek to translate this meaning in terms of concrete activities. His visible actions must first be justified by his invisible reflections. The world has no use for a doctrine which treats the common life of men as something alien and apart. The world is right. The philosopher does not know any point in this wide universe where truth should be kicked out. Hence he finds its principles are everywhere applicable and everywhere present and that whoever neglects them does so at his own peril. Philosophy is what is workable, it is put in practice, or it is only half philosophy. It believes in inspired action and illumined service. Its worth is not known to dilettanti who play with academic theories for a day and then forget them. It can be carried into action, it can be made of worth to the toilers, the sufferers and the executives of society. It shows everybody how he ought to live amid the particular circumstances in which he finds himself. For every deed of the genuine philosopher is the direct epilogue, the philosophic life descendant of those ideas of truth for which he has struggled so arduously. He learns the right rules of the game of life and sets out to obey them. Therefore philosophy is equally for the man doomed to hang from the ghastly gallows as for the man who dooms him from the grand judicial bench. It reveals a truth whose application to daily living arrests fear, removes doubt, supplies inspiration and kindles mental strength. Be we workers with hoe and plough, or surgeons with scalpel and lancet, or directors with glass-topped desks, we all meet with critical moments when we need the sure guidance, the firm pointing finger which philosophy alone can offer. For it alone is concerned with the rigid truth of a situation rather than with emotional distortions of it or egoistic veilings of it. Therefore the value of philosophy is the value of its practical contribution to day-to-day living. The connection between the office, the factory, the farm, the theater and the home with philosophy is direct and plain. Philosophy is the guide of all life. Its final worth is to tell us how to live, and how to meet and master our difficulties and temptations. The study of the hidden teaching demands that one pass through a severe intellectual discipline which may extend over some years, according to the reasoning capacity of the student. It certainly cannot be got in a hurry. Once this knowledge is won, however, it proves its practical worth by standing every test. The wisdom it confers, the ethic it upholds, the strength it gives, the tranquility it sheds and the intellectual capacity it develops, all combine to make the student who completes his course, who passes from nescience to knowledge, a better man. If he turns to politics, he will render superior service, and not inferior. If he takes up manufacturing, his products will be honest and meritorious. The man trained in the labors and pains of philosophical reflection will tackle each practical problem as it arises with clear insight, and only he, other things being equal, will be the most likely to give correct judgment upon a matter. All our ideas are dumb until we try to put them into practice. They then gain voice and people our message. The philosophic life is not a mere fragment to be lived out in a dusty library. It is a continuous experience, whether it be lived in a home, a business, a senate chamber or a farm. And a man will be a better citizen because he is a philosopher, just as he will be a better philosopher because he is a citizen. If his studies separate him outwardly from the general life of his community, then whatever else they may be, they are certainly not philosophic studies. For the philosopher has got to put the content of continuous disinterested action into the fine or clever phrases that he writes or utters, or he will merely be a hay philosopher. Only when the tenets of philosophy have entered his bloodstream can he become a real philosopher. Truth is a dynamic, not a narcotic. The philosopher will always be found rational, sensible, practical and balanced man in his everyday dealings. He well understands that the two wings of a bird must move to keep it in balanced flight, and that the two sides of man, thought and action, must operate to keep him in balanced existence. But his balance is wider than that. Amid the restless hustle of modern society, he keeps inwardly calm and undisturbed. And his peace is so hard forged as to endure when he passes out of the quiet philosophical sanctus into the busy street. The philosophic discipline trains the mind and through the mind all the acts of a man. Thoughts that are constantly and intensely held tend sooner or later to speak in deeds. It is because men have not realized the power of concentrated thinking to help or hurt others that they have brought forth the hideous age in which we are born. Without joining those who harm a good cause by poor logic and worse philosophy when they deny the power of external surroundings, we may yet say that the general and habitual line of thinking tends ultimately and largely to reproduce itself in the features of one's environment. The mind has both attractive and repulsive properties. It attracts other minds and material conditions of a like nature, it repels those of jarring kind. This activity constantly goes on in man's subconscious self. He need not always be aware of it to make it effective. This silent influence never ceases operating. Only when we see it strikingly made evident in the lives of good or evil geniuses do we dimly realize what potency lies hidden, controlled and concentrated thought. It is the invisible inner man of thought and feeling who dictates man's daily actions and reactions, who faces him when he is alone and who lives a secret existence which imperils or protects his whole external existence. The thoughts which most often occupy his mind and the moods which most frequently fill his heart are his invisible rulers and, in comparison with the physical body, constitute his more important self. The younger races of the West look first to the outward stature of a man when they wish to measure him, whereas the older people of Asia knew thousands of years ago that his greatest power for weal or woe lay hidden in his mind. The ancient epilogue, the philosophic life sages who sat with crossed legs and benignant faces in the Himalayan forests taught their reverent pupils this vital truth. Thus this teaching amply justifies itself on the most utilitarian grounds. On conduct and art. Everything or everyone is in relation to something or someone else. Nothing or nobody stands alone. The life of every creature is interwoven with the lives of others. Its fancied separateness of vaunted independence is a delusion. Humanity especially is interrelated. Therefore the philosopher is not merely a philosopher, he is also a member of society. He cannot escape being so, cannot completely disentangle himself. Even if he retreat to a cave, he will need another to attend him, or a dog to accompany him, or a cow to give him milk, and lo, there is a society of two already. How he conducts himself in this society will depend on ethical principles, which will remain precisely the same even if it were a society of 2 millions and not merely of two. Does philosophy, then, contribute anything to ethics, anything to values, anything to point out the right path of duty? The answer is that philosophy is the only thing in the world which makes such contributions to the fullest extent needed by human existence.